Hello, and welcome back to the first episode of the new, improved, weekly Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast who knows why a mouse is when it spins. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
I'm a lovely bucket of squidgy CSO glamour of the soul, Richard. Hello.
And I'm back from Kettlewell Hairdressers. One style fits all. And don't I look a treat?
Yes, that's certainly a word.
No need for any of us to floss at this time.
No, indeed, because we're about to see the Fourth Doctor in action for the first time in Robot. So this is the first story for the new Doctor, and indeed the Doctor, for many people, this is their Doctor. When you talk to people who aren't huge Doctor Who fans, mostly the one they remember is Tom Baker. And so we pick up right from the end of Planet of the Spiders. We have a reprise of the regeneration scene, which is the first time this has happened. There was no reprise in Power of the Daleks. There was no reprise in Spearhead, obviously, because it would have been black and white film. It's like a cliffhanger between seasons with the same kind of carryover. And straight away, Tom shows himself to be a very different character with sort of his random outbursts of dialogue. It's like the opposite of an exposition coma.
It's a sort of nonsense and nonsense.
Yeah. It's a non sequitur coma. And he's
the ADHD drug of choice, isn't he? This is a very odd story, isn't it? Because watching them all again and having seen them as a tiny, wee time tot, it's not a Tom story. It's a Pertwee story with a Pertwee crowd written by Pertwee's own Terence Dix. And doesn't Tom go in like a mistimed cog in a spring in a wheel that doesn't click and makes the whole works shebang and fall apart just by his mere presence? And they can never go back. It's proof positive. They can never do it the old way again. Doctor does not fit in the old form, and he won't allow it.
At the same time, though, Robert Holmes had essentially been script editor for the last three stories.
That's true. Death to the Daleks is very strongly a Bob story.
He doesn't fix this story, though. I mean, it is still stupid. It's still a Terence story.
I'll come back to that in a moment. But Robert Holmes describes the situation as he was shadowing, in inverted commas, Terence Dix, which meant he was sitting in Terence Dix's office
smoking, working
on the last three stories, and twice a week Terence Dix would poke his head around the door and say, "Everything all right? Aspirin's in the top drawer, you're fine." But where this story, I think, really starts to show straight away that there's a new production team coming in, of course it's still produced by Barry, as you say, it's still written by Terence, is the filmic influence of the story. Because Bob Holmes said to Terence, when Terence said, I'll write your first story, Bob. Bob Holmes said, "I want a King Kong-style story." And as we'll discover over the next 3 years, something that's really big for the Holmes-Hinchcliffe combination...
Is Nicken stuff
from films. And that happens.
Didn't they also say they wanted a sentimental provocateur, a sentimental monster? So it wasn't just that. They were also looking at Shelley's True Frankenstein, and that there's intimacy, and therefore between the Pearl White character, who is, you know, now we know, definitely know, Sarah Jane was cast as Pearl White with a veneer, with a carapace,
Pearl White,
okay.
Because is that Faye Ray's character?
Pearl White is the girl always getting tied to the train tracks in all those silent...
Penelope Pitstop kind of
that kind
of
was
archetype.
Definitely ripped off on the Pearl White character. So if we go back to the Silent Era, she was the girl who was always being tied in her bloomers to the railway tracks.
Because, I mean, if it was from the original King Kong, which is already kind of really problematic racially, the fact that Faye Ray's character was
and Hitler's favourite film.
Well,
and
I'm
Terence
not
Dix's.
At all surprised.
Allegedly. It was. He really loved it. This is more than just King Kong, though, isn't it, if we look at it? I mean, okay, we all get it, that there's the protagonist that has a soul. But this is actually, and we're looking over at Brendan's lovely credenza at the moment, gentle listener, to Gort, the fabulous Gort from The Day the Earth Stood Still in 1950, George Pal's. And really, it's just Super Jesus 9/11, isn't it? Apologies to American listeners, but every damn Superman film we've seen, every super film we've seen now is the world covered in pumice. And a superhero really just playing Michael Rennie was Ill the Day the Earth Stood Still, and he played Mr. Carpenter. Did you get it? Did you get it? And Gort is definitely the K-1 robot, but without a soul. So we're really just looking at, ooh, are we getting a bit Nietzschean here?
Oh,
we're allowed
definitely.
To use terms like that.
Certainly because, with the character of Hilda Winters.
Yes, we're getting. I think this story is the Nietzsche one, because we'll get to a lot of Jacques Lacan later in the season, and Mr. Hinchcliffe himself has referenced Jacques Lacan in several times in interviews. And that's the dissonance and the delay of the fear, the object of horror and the actual death, or the object of horror witnessed, lived with before the resolution, is the elongation of terror, the elongation of fear. And I'll
Do you
get
mean
to that later.
Not seeing the monster until the end of episode one?
Everyone's glazing over, as I say. We'll get to it at another point.
Yeah. You clarified that. I had no idea what you were talking about.
The point with this one is that you've got the larger than monster, or the larger than antagonist, who's the kind of the superego, who's kind of the man at his worst, but also revealing underneath that there's the transition, there's the chance for redemption, in that he's not actually, just like Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, who was the first one to do it, is that there is actually opportunity for redemption.
Mm. Yes.
And the tragedy is that that is generally not conceived. It's not, the narrative doesn't allow that to happen.
Mm. What I found so interesting about watching this story was that, as you mentioned earlier, Richard, it's clearly still a UNIT story. It's clearly playing with the John Pertwee toy box, if you like, of having UNIT and having this homegrown threat and what have you. But I think that's such a good idea, because it gives the audience something familiar for the new Doctor to be different against. So it immediately defines his character.
I agree completely with you, Brendan. I think at this point in time, Doctor Who has a solid audience of 8 to 9.5 million viewers every week. You know, for big events, they're getting an extra million and a half. Here you've got, in this regeneration story, you've got the familiar elements of the Brigadier Benton. Sarah's been in the show for a year, and she's the main protagonist of the whole story. You've got all of these elements supporting the new Doctor and allowing him to put his own sort of mark on things and how they react to his differences. Mm. What I really like about this is the fact that the Brigadier and Benton are actually so accepting, right, which is actually very warm and lovely. And Sarah, she's not angsty or anything like that, but it's really interesting watching Elizabeth Sladen's reactions. She's very positive, but she's sort of watching Tom and what he's going to say, and you think that Sarah's about to jump in like she would with Pertwee.
Like we do on this podcast.
But then you sort of see her then relax and sort of smile and joke, and sort of you go along with it, so you're accepting of it.
That's a great point.
It's actually her reactions and how Sarah reacts to the new Doctor, which I really loved in this.
Mm. Do you know, one of the things, though, that I think is odd is that really no one says anything very much, you know, beyond episode one and beyond just when he gets up and gets in his new outfit and that. He's just the Doctor, and no one really remarks ever again on the fact that he's sort of changed his appearance, and no one sort of feels odd about it.
Mm. You see, I would disagree with that. Certainly, okay, they don't say it, but Nick's performance against Tom is so different compared to his performance against Pertwee. There's a distrust there.
I can see it too. Yeah. And I actually thought that in a number of scenes, Nick's reactions here are very different. He looks very uncomfortable at times with what the Doctor is doing.
So I can see my contract ending.
Can I bring up Sandifer for the first time in the podcast?
I think you're going to.
Have a drink, boys.
Yeah. Sandifer just says that what's happening is you bring back the UNIT people as a kind of transition thing, but the effect of it is Tom just acts them all off the screen, is literally what he says. And so suddenly it becomes clear that we don't need UNIT. As Richard said, the contract is about to end, and in fact, this recording block, which ends with Terror of the Zygons, you know, we don't get UNIT ever really again in that sort of same role.
No, indeed.
We don't get the Brigadier again, do we?
Not after Zygons.
No, he's mysteriously unavailable. And you can blame him.
Yeah, no, he's in Geneva.
Sulking away with Doris in that mock Tudor get-up somewhere in the...
Well, you know, I do wonder about the Brig and Doris. This is just the first of several stupid observations of mine this season. When the Doctor is trying to remember who the Brigadier is, he compares him first to Hannibal and then Alexander the Great. Yes. And of course, what he's actually doing is comparing him to great military leaders. It's a really good step in their relationship because he's flattering him in a way.
And not both great generals who slept with other warriors.
Exactly. They're both history's famous bisexuals.
Yes.
In the scene right after Sarah Jane has called the Brigadier a swinger.
Yes!
Which made something very clear in 1974, yes, and boys and girls. Where's your car keys? Yeah.
Wasn't the Brigadier very keen to stifle any talk of Doris a few weeks ago Planet of the Spiders?
Yes. Yeah,
I think he and Doris have a very stable.
They have a very stable Doris relationship. Doris is usually working down the docks as a stevedore, huge 6'3" with a big, massive beard, much like Todd's hairdo.
That's no way. That's no way to talk about Angela Douglas.
Do we remember Angela Douglas from The Carry-Ons?
Wasn't she miraculous in that? And of course, one of our old one of our old picks of the week, Daleks versus Mekons,
yes,
the trailer. She's been co-opted into that. And you know what? We're getting ahead of ourselves. She finally appears in Doctor Who, she's hardly bloody aged in
she's
20
gorgeous,
years. She looks magnificent.
She? Much like everyone in this thing, too. Don't you love Benton? Don't you look at him and think, this is this lovely Indian summer purple twilight thing of saying goodbye to old friends? And you do love him, don't you?
Well, he gets a promotion, doesn't he? He gets to be Mr. Benton from
he's
now
Mr.
on.
Mr. Benton. He's but, an RSM.
The thing that we've completely not mentioned at all is, you know what I'm
Harry
gonna say?
Harry Sullivan.
Yeah. We kept the best till last, didn't we?
Yeah.
Todd, well, how do you reckon Harry fits in?
He's so immediate.
Isn't he?
He's so immediate, and he's Tom, and he's Tom's new buddy. And that's evident in this run of stories.
Do you think it would have worked as well without Harry? I really don't.
No. And I know that Harry was brought in because they were thinking about casting an older actor. That famous story about Richard Hearn thinking they wanted him to play it like Mr. Pastry.
And we had Mr. Moody, the lovely Ron Moody.
Who just passed this week.
And, well, he could have been, I believe, three Doctors. I think he was in the running for
He could have done his own season 10 special. Imagine the money they would have saved.
Yeah, exactly. Ian Marta was brought in to be the man of action against the older Doctor, much like the same reason that Richard Franklin was brought in before they suddenly realised, hold on,
Todd's busting to say something.
Really a man of action. Two, you don't need a man of action with Pertwee.
No, you don't. I actually think Richard Franklin was perfect casting because there's lots of boys who went to Sandhurst who are the younger sons
of
clergy.
He is an officer.
Yeah, well, he's you, as Nancy Mitford would have said, not non-you. He's one of the posh boys who really wasn't supposed to be there, but a lot of them come out of that military school and they're quite fain. They'd much rather just do etchings with other chaps. But it ended up... Did you know, and I think it's actually okay to reveal this now that, you know, we've gone on, Ian Marta was, according to the studio notes, have you come across this, actually was cast but was unavailable.
Yeah,
that's right. No, we mentioned
and Richard
that.
Franklin was always available. So, I mean that to all his mates. He was always available to his mates. And it was kind of like, I think it's sterling casting.
Oh yeah,
of Dickie Franklin.
Yeah, you know what? As I've detailed. He's
nearly no one we've mentioned.
Can we actually get to the listener loves that.
Look, when we last saw him, he was resting in Kevin Lindsay's lap, and really, what else do you need?
Passed away very soon after. Of a heart attack.
Well, what a way to go.
What else do you want to say about
Ian,
we talked about Harry.
Yeah, Harry. We're still on Harry.
Something about Harry.
As you were saying, Todd, you know, he's so immediate in that, and to compare him to Captain Yates, you know, not necessarily to Richard Franklin, but when Captain Yates arrives, there's several lines of dialogue to intimate he's only been there for a few weeks.
No, that's not true.
Saying,
they actually say
you've been around since the other Auton thing. So
he said I've cleaned up. But there's lots of dialogue to establish him, to say, oh, Mike is this and Mike is that. Whereas Harry just walks into the room and the Brigadier's like, oh, thank you, Sullivan.
You know what?
No, he phoned him in the previous story.
But that's what I mean.
On one of those swinger lines they used to have in those days, yes.
Mike Yates is established as having been there through people saying, oh, you've been here for a while, whereas Harry Sullivan is established as having been there just because people treat him
Do you think
like
it's also that Ian just has such a strong screen presence and actually matches Tom and beguilingly does the sotto voce to Tom's forte, forte, forte. But it's actually a really lovely duality.
Yeah,
Sarah is just the triumvirate that makes it stand up.
That amazing skipping rope scene. I mean, compare that to the fetch a tin of cocoa scene. you've got two actors as equals in the skipping rope scene, whereas in the fetch a tin of cocoa scene, Richard Franklin is very subservient to John Pertwee because that was just the performance style.
That's how Pertz liked it.
But it's so obvious in so many scenes that Tom and Ian are acting their socks off compared to Nick. And Elizabeth rises to the occasion. You can see it. There's a Kettlewell scene like in his office. And honestly, you know, the three of them are fantastic. And Nick in the background, I'm just there going, you are struggling, matey. And I'm not trying to be horrible or anything like that.
Well, you know what? They've got a lot to deal with. We haven't mentioned the theme song in the room. Wrote the theme song, sang the theme. Miss Winters. We haven't mentioned Miss Winters.
No.
I think it's very difficult for the male supporting cast to actually do anything but gaze in mute admiration at the stoic presence that is Patricia Maynard, writer of the Minder theme and girlfriend of Dennis Waterman at the time.
Is that true?
That is absolutely true.
Mother of Hannah Waterman,
yeah.
In fact.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm going to go out there. This is possibly Doctor Who's strongest feminist story to date.
And also probably its most reviling in that everyone who's a feminist is a horrible, horrible villain monster who's humourless and cold. And although they do have nice clothes, nice boots.
Well, I think you can also consider as feminist that none of the men treat Miss Winters negatively because she is a woman.
Only Sarah does.
Only Sarah does.
Doesn't she get pulled up on that one? Yeah, she gets
pulled up brilliant. And the thing is, you sort of look at Sarah, and Sarah is a strong, independent woman in a man's world, which is why she assumes a man is in charge. Mm.
She doesn't really meet many women. I mean, this year, there will be three speaking women in the entire show.
The last one she met was Queen Thenira, for goodness sake.
Oh, I've just realised you're right. That's
it's
terrible.
It's really, really terrible. She's actually met one of these women things that she hardly ever comes across.
She got on well with Queen Thenira.
She did. She taught her to bite her enemies.
Which is funny when you think of her successor in the companion role. But it's so worth commenting on the strong women in this storyline because of its basis in King Kong, where Fay Wray's role was as a mother and a nurturing figure to Kong and to be captured and to be used as a commodity and what have you.
And Patricia Neal in Day the Earth Stood Still, and very Patricia similar. Neal, but she played it, again, that's a lovely role if you haven't seen the film, because she plays it as a highly intelligent woman.
Mm. Well, see, that's exactly what Sarah and Miss Winters are.
Mm.
Especially with Sarah's sympathy for the robot. Now, that's also very mothering, but it goes from being a mothering and nurturing idea to being a discussion about the nature of intelligence and sentience. And it's Sarah and Miss Winters leading that discussion in the storyline.
It's not really Kettlewell, it's Miss Winters who is the Dr. Frankenstein. Frankenstein!
Yeah, exactly.
In this one.
Exactly.
Young Frankenstein had been out by now.
So. Kettlewell is Igor.
Yeah. And who's Jellicoe?
Jellicoe was almost Colin Baker.
He was, yes. Can you imagine?
In an Ian Marto and Richard Franklin kind of way, Colin Baker was picked for the part but wasn't available. So we got Alec Linstead instead.
I like that he's got that lovely thing when gingers were terribly rare in the 70s because they didn't have the penicillins that we have now. So they didn't live very long. You didn't get as many gingers.
Oh, it's terrible.
It's true. They're all expiring of anaphylactic shock. In those days, you couldn't open a jar of peanut butter without seeing a ginger collapse.
I think a packet of crushed biscuits. Are you confusing gingers with ginger nuts?
Same difference. Yeah. Really. And stop that. It's a family podcast.
Are you going to say something?
I just wanted to say that Jellicoe, of course, is coded as gay in the novelisation by Terrence,
A bit like Professor Whittaker.
Musical theatre?
No, he's overly trendy and fashionable in his dress for someone of his age. So he takes a little bit too much care in his appearance. And I can't think why else Terrence would mention that detail except to try and code him as gay. And because
so he has to die.
No, he doesn't die.
No, he does die, interestingly. He just disappears off the narrative.
You have to explain why he's subordinate to a woman,
Oh, and he can only be subordinate to a woman if he's homosexual.
Queer. Yeah.
That's right.
Thanks, Terrence.
I knew he'd get that in somewhere, yeah. We still love him.
I mean, well, it's just been announced this week that Sam Smith is singing the new Bond theme.
It's got to be Bassy.
Yeah.
But Sam Smith is an homosexual.
Oh, okay.
Ah. So you're doing it as Dame Shirley Bassy.
As Dame Shirley Bassy. And also, I doubt he'll be whistling in the theme, of course, for the new Bond theme.
No, Quiz can't whistle.
Ian Fleming
believed that. But it was actually a great urban myth at the time that if you were homosexual, you couldn't whistle, which is why there's that scene between
When you consider Quentin Crisp Duckface.
Can't whistle.
It's actually
so weird, Todd.
It's actually...
No, I just don't get it.
Do you know they actually put it down to the oblation of the palate?
I have a confession to make, is that when I came to watch this, I had to actually unwrap it out of its plastic.
No.
In fact, every single season that I've actually watched thus far, I've had to actually unwrap at least two or three stories.
Oh, goodness.
Like that many. I just couldn't believe it.
Todd, you're so fresh.
Except for season 7. So it's probably why I like season 7 so much.
I love season 7.
But I actually put the DVD in and then I pushed play.
Yeah.
And I had absolute chills. Like, as that two sidebars go into the TARDIS block, I was just like, you know, literally shaking. I just couldn't believe the sort of response I was having to watching this story again. And it's like when the show came back in 96, when you heard the theme again, you just goosebumps that you got. And I just have had it watching this entire run of stories. You guys have all talked about the first stories that you have watched and you can remember. And I can't really remember what my first story was. As I watched that, I started trying to think about it. Mm. And there's this moment a few minutes into the episode, the point of view of the robot when it's trying to break into the research establishment with the wire mesh and the green grass. And as a kid, I had a recurring nightmare that we lived in a train tunnel and we had our front door and there were these two panels next to the door. And it was like what the robot was, you know, there was something outside and we couldn't see what it was. As I watched it, I saw that. And then all these flashes just started going into my mind, like Sarah crawling through the pipe with the weirin outside, Sarah falling off the scaffolding in Genesis, Sarah being attacked by the Cybermat.
There's a theme emerging here.
And I don't know whether or not Robot is the first story I ever saw, right? I kind of knew that John Pertwee was the Doctor, so I must have caught something of Spiders. But, you know, I was racking my brain, even in the Sontaran experiment when Sarah talks about Lynx, like, I don't remember that. Like, I don't... I never got that. I can't remember if I knew that she knew the Daleks or not. I do remember as a kid watching episode 1 of The Time Warrior, expecting the old Pertwee titles, getting the new ones and going, oh, and then going, oh, they're like Toms. So I didn't really know that.
No, yeah, about 77, 78.
So I'm just sort of there going like, you know, is Robot the first story that I ever saw? I just adored watching this from beginning to end. It was just fresh. He was vibrant. There were just things in the robot and the sympathy I felt for the robot and its and how conflicted it was. Like, I'd forgotten all of that stuff.
Doesn't it look beautiful too? Oh. Even it may not move quite as beautiful.
So, you know, I actually think
Jim Acheson, is it?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah, it's Jim Acheson.
It is. Yes. Oscar award winning and Jenny Laird award winning Jim Acheson. But on the other hand, Todd, I actually think that this story is kind of terrible as well. And part of the reason for it, and maybe the biggest reason for it, is Kettlewell. Because you remember when Kettlewell last appeared, when the actor last appeared on the show?
Yes, Edward Burnham as Professor Watkins in The Invasion.
And do you remember that scene where Tobias Vaughn kind of tries to provoke Watkins into killing him? And there's some actual proper acting and all of that sort of thing. But in the intervening time, he's just turned into just an absurd caricature. And he's so important to the plot. And I think his role in the plot is absolutely unbelievably muddled as well. Like, I can't tell what's going on. He looks really distressed when the robot turns up at his house. Mm-hmm. And he's surprised and all of that sort of thing. And when the robot explains to him what's been being done to him at Think Tank, he goes, oh, no, you know, all of that sort of thing. But then it turns out that scene's a complete cheat because he was actually in on it the entire time. And the only way that we can work that out, you know, the audience can't possibly work that out. We've got no way of knowing. Tom works it out in his sleep. Do you know what I mean? And then comes to and says, oh, you know, no one else could possibly have reprogrammed the robot, even though we saw in a scene Hilda and Jellicoe doing just that. So the story is a mess. Do you know what I mean? It is a giant holdover from the Pertwee era, which is not, you know, not suggesting that it's wrong to have affection for it, because of course its place in the history of the show. It's got Tom, who is just, you know, an absolute revelation. And it's got Holmes, you know, fixing the dialogue.
Look, I don't disagree with you. I mean, Jellicoe's acting sometimes, his calculator acting is appalling when he's trying to do those calculations. He's not fooling anybody. He's not fooling me for a second.
And he's got that wonderful bit where he's hiding behind the robot, helping him down the stairs, helping him up the steps, hiding acting.
But I was just surprised at how much I actually did enjoy this when I had dismissed it offhand previously. And so I actually did have great affection when I was watching this and was quite surprised. But there are problems with his character and motivation, you know, and Tom is, as you said, Richard, it just doesn't quite fit and it becomes quite obvious. Mm. But at the same time, I like that it doesn't quite fit because I think it gives Tom the chance to shine and stamp a different approach to everything.
It really was perfect in that, wasn't it?
Walsh Watch. Terry Walsh isn't credited in this story at all, but there is a hilarious scene where the doctor's trying to persuade a guard to let him into the Scientific Reform Society.
Yes.
And he does that thing, you know, where he gets out his wallet and he's got the freedom of the city of Skaro. Who gave him that? The Daleks. And, you know, he's a member of the Alpha Centauri Table Tennis Club. And it's been observed before that if they have six arms, why do they get six table tennis bats? Because two armed people only get one. Why don't they have three table tennis bats? But whatever. But the person that he's trying to bamboozle into allowing him in is Terry Walsh. Yeah. And Terry Walsh is the recipient of the very first Tom Baker scarf trick. So where he accidentally treads on Tom's scarf and Tom yanks it out of the way and he falls and hurts, which is why it's Terry Walsh. So
and he also does this excellent dive over the top of Tom while Tom is standing on a higher level to him, bending over, then turns around and gets Tom in an arm lock. You know, it's really a very, very good stunt, considering it also looks like it was done in one take with no cuts whatsoever.
Probably would have been too. Walsh was great at all of it.
The last thing I want to mention is actually related to that that scene at the Scientific Reform Society meeting, with, of course, their wonderful emblem that is not only designed to look like the robot's head, but also to sort of resemble a reflected swastika. Terence Dix had been writing with Mac Hulk long before they turned in the War Games together. And in fact, in the 1962-63 season of The Avengers, when it was Patrick McNee and Honor Blackman in the starring roles, they wrote a story together called The Mauritius Penny, which is about a group called New Rule who want to overtake the UK and Europe and run it along scientific principles. The third episode of Robot, the scenes in that, the way they are written, the way they are shot, is so close to The Mauritius Penny, which is also one of the best black and white videotape Avengers
voted
episodes.
Top fan favourite of that season.
I mean, when I used to run my Avengers blog, I think I put it either first or second for that season. It's so strong. Do track it down if you can, folks. It's not available on DVD in Australia, but it is available in the UK and the US as part of the complete second
YouTube
season.
Too.
And often on YouTube or Vimeo.
Should we mention, do we have time, that all of those things actually came from a real organisation called Technocracy, which developed in the US straight after the war, and a lot of second-rate scientists, as they were viewed by everybody else. And they wanted a streamlined, logical lifestyle. Based on pseudoscientific rational principles. They wore grey suits. It's really just Kraftwerk without the great tunes. And they drove a model of grey car all the same.
But there is actually a C.S. Lewis novel called That Hideous Strength, which was written during the war, set immediately after it, which has the National Institute of Coordinated Experiments, which is a cross between think tank and the Scientific Reform Society. So it is a thing that was in the air. It's not quite as crazy as it seems to us.
You love
C.S.
Lewis, don't you?
Yeah, he's top of my enemies list at the moment.
Frenemies.
There's two things that we need really to talk about, I think, before we wrap it up. One is the tank.
I love the tank.
I love the tank. I love the tank.
I don't really have a problem with it. I don't. Yeah. I think it looks a lot better than a lot of the model work in the Pertwee era.
Yeah.
And I think the shot is quite clever. The shot on the robot.
Look, it's cute.
The shot as a boy.
I accepted it as a kid.
Yep.
As a boy, I thought fantastic. We've got a bit of Thunderbirds moments. We do need to talk about the toys. What did you think of the tank?
It's terrible. and then there's the end. And I think the end is really, really just lovely. So you get the scene with Tom and Sarah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Sarah is genuinely upset by
Is this Sarah still as the 6-inch dolly?
No.
Yeah, okay, that's a jingly legs of that Sarah dolly. Yes. As Tom. She's then placed on that matte painting of the chimney.
It's a photo of the chimney.
And she's grasped down to nothing.
That was a reshoot as well. They weren't happy with the original version.
Jenny Lederwood nomination.
Todd is the only one here who's spent some reasonable amount of time with Liz Sladen. But Liz did say, and I'm quoting this now, they did very rude things with that Sarah Dolly after that. Nothing to do with me, of course. And she does include Terry Walsh in that. Do you remember her telling that story to the conventions? Anyway, so I
have no recollection.
This is why it's never turned up at any of the auctions.
Oh my god.
Anyway, the last scene.
The last scene.
That last heartwarming scene. Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
Are we on to the bucket of red goo?
No, we passed that.
We passed the red bucket up.
She's genuinely upset by the destruction of the robot, and it's terribly sweet. And Tom doesn't, you know, for all his sort of alien quirkiness, he really takes it on board and tries to comfort her.
Yes.
And he does say, you know, it was a great invention or something capable of great good or great evil.
Yes.
You know, I guess you could say
it was human.
And I think that's terrifically nice.
It's great, isn't it? Yeah, what we were trying to say before.
And then, you know, you've got Harry coming in, and would you like a jelly baby the first time he ever says it?
Yeah,
you know?
And the ticket to the TARDIS is the jelly baby.
They trick him into going into the TARDIS.
Wonderful.
They're having a little
naughty
joke.
That's why that coat was definitely worn by the second Doctor.
Because
there's something else that comes up later in the season to indicate that.
For his costume, I do think, though, that the alternate costume he tries on, the clown and the barbarian and the king of hearts, he's already chosen what he wants to wear. Yeah, he's just doing the Patrick Troughton trick of suggesting something completely outrageous.
They play a little bit of Tootie Flying Dutchman when he comes out in the Wagner hat. It's great. The space helmet for a cow.
It's already in the opening titles. We know what he's going to wear.
Actually, that's true, isn't it?
Well spotted, Todd.
That's all the time we have for Robot, but just before we go, I do have to issue a correction for something one of us said last episode.
It was Richard.
Yeah, it was me, probably.
It was me, actually. For my Jenny Laird Award, I gave it to the creative team behind The Mutants because I was asking why Christopher Barry was invited back after such a long time away to direct such a problematic story. I'm completely overlooking the fact that he'd done a bloody great job on the Damon. Three stories before that. So, you know, I was saying he hadn't been directing since Power of the Daleks. He hasn't done a colour Doctor Who. He hasn't worked for Barry Litz. Of course he has. And he's produced one of the most critically acclaimed ones.
So we can finally accept The Mutants as in the top five Pertwees.
We've never issued a correction before. Is that because we've never said anything wrong before?
That's correct.
It's because it would take up an entire episode.
In 31 episodes, I think that's quite a great achievement. So, folks, as I said, that's the end of today's episode. Please come back next week where we'll be discussing packaging materials as alien threats in the Arkan space. In the meantime, don't forget, you can find us online at flightthroughentirety.com, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and iTunes, and FTE Podcast on Twitter. We're also still after reviews on our iTunes, because I put out a call for it about 2 episodes ago, and I don't think any new reviews have appeared. Not being needy, I'm being incredibly needy. Please review us. Please, please, please review us.
There might be something in it for you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
See you soon.
You've been listening to Flight Through Entirety with Todd Bilby, Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones and Richard Stone. This episode, Quentin Crisp Duckface, was recorded on Sunday, the 14th of June. The next episode will be released on June 28th. The Doctor's sporting prowess does rather raise the question, how many ping pong balls are in play in a game of Alpha Centurion table tennis?
Hey! Hello, and welcome back to the first episode of the weekly Flight Through Entirety. I excited myself just then. Okay.